Radio.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
And welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 7th of October, 2016, and you are listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Joining me today, as always, I have Mr. Dennis Wise, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, and we also have Messerschmitt with some more of his Axis war heroes for you. Dennis, how are you doing today?
I'll do fine, thanks. Looking forward to today's program and Messerschmitt's excellent pieces on these war heroes.
Same here. I believe this is part four that we're going to hear tonight. How are you doing today, Messerschmitt?
Oh, I'm doing fine, thanks. I got a slight headache, but it's not bad. And I don't know why it came on. The weather has been absolutely brilliant today, so can't be weather related, I would say.
No, I think you get really good weather up there. In the Alps, in Switzerland, lovely, crisp, clean air. I really prefer the winter sun to the summer sun, to be honest. I hate being all hot and sweaty. I'd much rather have bright winter sun and be able to see for miles without any haze and not be too hot. That's the sort of sun that I prefer. I suppose that's Nordic sun, I guess you would call it, rather than tropical sun. I wouldn't imagine that you get too many colds over there, to be honest, Schmidt.
Well, no, I don't get sick much. If I do, quite so, but yeah. Oh, and I did my first steps in sound editing this week. You taught me the ropes a bit, and I put the Degrelle presentation into one part. And I tried the idea I had with the multimedia thing, and but the free video editing program I tried really didn't cut it. So I ordered myself a professional video editing program, and yeah, I hope this will turn out well and people will like it to see it with video footage.
No, that's good. I'm sure the listeners will be pleased to hear that. I know people are really interested in. Hearing this, hearing them all put together into one with video footage as well, that should be pretty successful when it comes out. I mean, it's quite a few that we've done now, isn't there? Must be four or five at least of these different Axis war heroes. How many is there in all so far? Do you remember?
I've lost track, actually, but it's way more than four. I would say 10, 12 maybe. I mean, we've been doing this for almost a year, I just realized recently, because when we started this, when I first called in, it was dark outside. And from then on, in spring, it used to be light when we did the show. And now it's dark again. So I think almost three quarters of a year have passed.
Wow. Flies, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed.
Flies when you're making podcasts, I tell you. It does take up a fair bit of time. I know you put a lot of work into producing these, Schmidt, and we're all very grateful for that. This is part four of Hans Joachim Marseille, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Should I go ahead and recap last week?
Yeah. Give us a recap. Remind us of where we got up to last week.
Okay, and... In part three, we talked about the ground war again, Operation Battle Axe. I quoted conversations between Marseille and his friend Stahlschmidt, and I last quoted a dogfight description from the biography. And now the time came when it all came together for Marseille. He was a well-liked comrade in the squadron, had no quarrel with his superior officers, and his dogfighting theories were now successfully put into practice. Here's Marseille describing how he breaks up an enemy defensive circle. Quote, Marseille had developed his technique to perfection in the interim. He was able to fire from all attitudes, as if in a dream. He related his theory of this neck-breaking attack method to Pötken. Pötken was one of his comrades, also his wingman at times. I'll pass one or two times through the circle from above, then move in behind the aircraft I've chosen. On the third pass, however, when the enemy expects something totally different, I dive from my higher altitude past the defensive circle. build up more and more speed, and pull up again into a half loop, then do a half roll and shoot down the closest one while on my back. End quote. I have to admit that I don't understand it. It may sound relatively simple, but to me it's not simple at all. The disorientation that one would feel while flying upside down is probably only the least of the problems. And when he shoots at the enemy fighter in the circle from above, which he also frequently did, he would even be faster and have even less time to calculate in his mind the deflection needed to hit the target. Imagine yourself in the cockpit of a 109 diving down on airplanes flying in a circle below you. You will approach them at a speed of around 700 kilometers per hour, maybe even faster. 1 second they will seem like tiny specks below you, and 3 seconds later you've already shot past them. While they are moving in a circle, and your aim is not to hit one of them by spraying wildly with your machine guns in the hope that one of the bullets will hit one of the fighters, but using very short bursts like Marseille did and hitting precisely where you want. Not put some holes in the wings, for example, that would most likely not cause too many problems for your opponent. At least not immediately. You might puncture the tanks, but that would not really bring down the airplane immediately. You would want to hit the engine or the cockpit, preferably. And it wasn't just that he was able to fly at very high speeds and then somehow hit his targets while the opponent is maneuvering and he himself is. He would at times fly so slowly that he had to extend his flaps so his airplane wouldn't stall, shoot an allied plane out of the circle and not get hit himself. As I said, it's beyond me how he did it. Nobody could do it but him. He explained it to them, they saw him do it, but nobody could fly and shoot like he could. And so a lot of the time his comrades in the air would just watch him as if they were mere spectators, only there to watch with their own eyes what seemed impossible.
Was he actually doing loop, sort of a loop the loop thing before hitting them, or was he sort of circling horizontally? Was he doing a complete circle, flying upside down, and then, you know, picking up speed and then firing at them? Is that what he was doing?
Well, actually, his concept was to never do the same thing twice and to be able to shoot from all angles. His concept was also that he would adapt what he did to the situation. So it was very unpredictable. And he would shoot them from above, from below. He would even enter the circles and fly with them for a few moments, which also boggles my mind, because why wasn't he shot down while he did that?
He must have actually had eye contact with them when he was doing that.
Yeah. Yes, I would imagine so.
Wow. Maybe if he was flying at the same speed as them, it would have been hard for them to shoot him. They would have had to sort of slow down, wouldn't they, to get behind him, if you see what I mean.
Yes, okay, yeah, that's a possibility, that they were so surprised that he was so slow, they would have to kill their speed first before they could get behind him. But I'm not alone in not really understanding. His comrades couldn't believe what they were seeing either.
It'd be good to see some footage of it, wouldn't it?
Oh yes, definitely.
There wouldn't be any, but would have been good to see something like that.
And what we have are the descriptions of his comrades who were actually there with him, because the author of the biography talked to these people and wrote down what they told him.
Have we got some of that?
I've already quoted, for example, Stahlschmidt, his comrade, what he thought about his shooting ability and his flying. And these dogfight descriptions are composed from the reports from his comrades in later years.
Okay.
So, if you are in a pursuit turn, that is, you are trying to shoot down an enemy fighter, that that is turning very tightly, you have to try to match his turn. But more than that, if you bring your gun sight to bear exactly on the enemy plane and shoot, by the time the bullets will have reached the spot where the enemy was when you press the button, he will have moved on. So you need to use deflection shooting, sometimes also called leading a target. You have to move your gun sight and therefore change the alignment of your airplane in front of the enemy into flight target, so that when you shoot, the flight path of the bullets and the enemy will intersect. Or in other words, the enemy plane will fly into your stream of bullets. I hope I was able to explain that in a sufficient way that makes sense. And yeah, as I mentioned, I'm intending to do these multimedia presentations. And maybe once I do that, I'll be able to use a flight simulator video, perhaps even historical actual footage to illustrate it. Not of Marseille, of course, but there are cockpit footage films that have been made during dogfights.
Well, that would be good to see. I mean, it's hard to imagine quite what he was doing, because I was sort of imagining a loop thing, so that he was coming down with extra speed and where they wouldn't see him because he was up above them, and then suddenly he'd come down out of the loop, flying up underneath them. Or can you imagine what I mean?
I think so. Yes, he did that in a way. At times he did that. He would pick up speed. He would be flying above them, off the circle, pick up speed, dive through them. Sometimes hit one target when he did that. Then he would come up again, flying vertically up, losing speed, and then, as I said, sometimes even enter the circle, go behind an enemy, shoot it down, and then get out of the circle again. So that is, by the way, what Stahlschmidt meant in his letter home when he wrote that Marseille shoots like a young god, that the likes of himself, Stahlschmidt, did not hit a thing when they tried to, quote-unquote, shoot in the curve. Because, you see, if you try to line your plane so that the gun sight is in the suspected flight path of the enemy, unless you are quite far away from your target, what will happen is that the enemy actually disappears from your view. The line of sight is interrupted by your own instrument panel. And Marseille, well, he was able to somehow accurately calculate in his head when exactly to shoot, even though he did not see his target anymore. On top of that, if you turn very tightly at great speeds, the gravitational forces will press you into your seat. The harder you pull on the stick, the greater the force you experience. And so if you pull 6 G's, which means the acceleration causes you to experience 6 times the normal gravitational force, you are 6 times heavier, as if you were on a planet with 6 times the gravity of Earth. In Marseille's case, as he weighed 120 pounds, he would, in actual fact, experience a weight of 850 pounds, or 60 kilos normally, 360 kilos, in that tight turn at great speed with 6G. What happens to you in that situation is that the blood inside your body flows to your legs, and at a certain point, you start to lose your vision. First, you get tunnel vision, then you lose your vision altogether, and beyond that, you lose consciousness. Anyone who has ever been in a roller coaster ride will have experienced the G-forces to a degree, but of course they are far from being as severe as those in a hard-turning dogfight. And in modern jet fighters, the pilots wear anti-G suits. These suits have inflatable bladders or compartments which are pressurized with either water or air to restrict the flow of blood to the lower parts of the body, to prevent the brain being starved of blood and thus oxygen. These suits allow pilots to withstand up to 9G or even beyond for a short period of time. But these suits did not exist in the 1940s, of course. Rolf Schröer, one of Marseille's comrades, describes the effect of those G-forces on the pilot. Quote, "These powerful G-forces could only cause any pilot to black out for a short period of time. It happened to me one time where I lost consciousness while in a dive, coming to only when my BF-109 was climbing again. I was shaking like a leaf, unquote. So he went into a steep dive and pulled hard on the stick to get out of the dive, but he became unconscious in the process and only woke up when his airplane was already climbing, meaning he kept pulling on the stick even though he was unconscious. Not everybody was so lucky, and a lot of pilots have died because they did not regain consciousness in time. Even though Marseille was of slight physique and he was able to endure these forces and exert sufficient power on the stick to pull these tight turns. And after landing, when he got out, he was smiling as if nothing stressful had happened. In these days of his first spectacular successes, he was also promoted to Leutnant, bringing his days as eternal Oberfähnrich to an end. After a short leave following his 15th air victory, he came back to Africa from Berlin, refreshed and relaxed. It was clear that he was still the youthful, high-spirited flyer as he played several practical jokes out with his colleague Wildau. Unfortunately, I don't know what they consisted of, as it is only mentioned in passing in the biography. The British would often try to bomb the airfield where Marseille and his comrades were stationed, but on at least one occasion this was foiled by the squadron's engineer, who with his men had built a dummy airfield which the British bombed in a night raid. But on another occasion they learned that the airfield they had occupied the night before had been completely bombed to pieces. They would move from one airfield to another quite often. A runway was not needed. The 109 can take off from even a grass strip, or in this case, a desert strip on sand, if need be. The enemy was not the only danger for a German pilot in Africa, as Marseille found out, as in August 1941, he was given orders to transfer an aircraft from the Gazala airfield to the Tripoli via Benghazi. At first, everything went smoothly. He landed in Benghazi to refuel, but the weather developed in a strange way. The sun was if behind a veil, and he felt as if he was in a greenhouse. The wind picked up and small clouds of sand began to form near the airfield. "Be careful, Herr Leutnant," one of the ground crew told him. "It looks like a nasty ghibli." That's what the locals called a sandstorm. The meteorologist had predicted sandstorms, but not in Marseille's flight path. Once in the air, however, the storm began to overtake him. He tried bypassing it by heading out to sea, but the sandstorm seemed to be following him. Visibility had gotten very poor. He was not sure anymore where exactly he was, and after a while he saw that he only had half an hour's worth of fuel left. He tried climbing out of the storm, but that didn't work out. At 1,000 meters altitude, he was still in the same gray-brown soup. When he had only 5 minutes left, he knew that he had to do something. He pushed his stick forward and constantly checking the altimeter, the compass, and the fuel gauge, he strained his eyes to see what was in front of him. Suddenly, he saw a massive perpendicular shadow in front of him. It was the Arco dei Fileni, a monument he had passed in that truck with the Italian driver before he found better transportation in the form of that general's car, as we heard in part two. It seemed like a Fata Morgana, but it was real. Marseille now knew exactly where he was, and turning, he headed for the Arco airfield. He was able to see much better now, but there was still a lot of sand in the air. He could not see farther than 100 meters. Yet he turned in for the landing and made a smooth landing. As he climbed out of his machine, the man from the flight control came running up. "Where did you come from?" asked the first to arrive at the airplane. "From the sky, as you can see," retorted Marseille with a boyish grin. "Man, how did you get here? You can't see anything out there," called the officer, out of breath from running. "I came from Benghazi," explained Marseille. "Everything sucked in there too." "When I left, it wasn't." "Then you can celebrate your birthday tonight in Tripoli," said the Hauptmann and grinned back at Marseille. Now, the author of the biography may have taken some artistic license in recounting such detailed descriptions of what happened, But as I said before, he did talk to the people who were closer to Marseille. In this case, it was again Stahlschmidt who told this story about the sandstorm as it was told to him by Marseille himself. But back to Marseille's dogfighting. I'm going to read a description from the biography about the first time he was able to put into practice his theories regarding the defensive circles. Well, what he had been practicing in his mind for quite some time. After Marseille had shot down a Maryland bomber on the morning of the 24th, he became embroiled later in the afternoon in a dogfighting involving roughly 20 enemy aircraft. They were sighted by the first group of Jagdgeschwader 27, which had been on a Freie Jagd. The first planes spotted were from 3rd Squadron, Royal Australian Air Force, which were making a reconnaissance in force in the area of Sidi Omar. Two of these planes caught sight of two Ju-88s, those are medium German bombers. They broke from their formation and turned towards the bombers to shoot them down. Flight Lieutenant Saunders and Sergeant Hiller attacked. Saunders shot down one of the Ju-88s while Hiller was beaten off. This was what saved him, for immediately following their attack, six Bf-109s arrived on the scene. They shot Saunders down, who was able to bail out with a slight wound. It was 1700 hours when the battle began, which would turn out to be Marseille's breakthrough. Nine Hurricanes from the 1st Squadron, South African Air Force, were patrolling the front. Not far off flew an additional nine aircraft of another unit. As these 18 aircraft approached the Hellfire Pass in loose formation and began searching for targets of opportunity, the bulk of the 1st Gruppe swung into action. They pounced from out of the sun. Marseille and his wingman, Oberfeinrich Kugelbauer, today, swooped down on the British, which by this time had scattered to all sides in order to form a Loufbery circle, which was still the best type of defense in air combat. Flying in such a formation, one fighter was able to protect the tail of another. The entire Staffel struck from an altitude of 6,000 meters above the Halfaya Pass. Marseille was all eyes and thought. Within a few seconds, he went over the moves of his attack in his mind. He repeatedly tested his action on his own Staffel as they would return from a mission. His drive to master this attack profile and to use it successfully bordered on possession and the unquenchable desire to do what no pilot before him had been able to do. Violating every rule of the air, he would have to show that the attack could be successfully carried out from all flight attitudes. Following his shoot-down of the Maryland, Marseille had 19 kills to his credit. This day would see more. Via the air-to-air link, Marseille heard the faintly rasping sound of his Staffel Kapitän calling out a warning. He glanced forward. There they were. He counted several glinting specks. With a single reflexive movement, he loosened his parachute harness. A flick of the lever and the weapons indicator light began glowing. Marseille dove onto the first enemy, still with Oberfeinrich Kugelbauer flying behind him as his wingman. The quarry tried to pull up to the left to get away, but with a clearly superior advantage in speed, built up from his deep dive, Marseille rapidly closed the distance. Pulling up into a tight left turn, Marseille opened fire. The enemy's left wing was already burning as Marseille shot steeply past. As Kugelbauer was observing Marseille's kill, a Hurricane got in behind him and began firing, that is, behind Kugelbauer. Only when tracers began whizzing by just in front of his windscreen did Kugelbauer recognize the precariousness of his situation. He kicked the rudder pedal and saw Marseille whip around to the left below him and fire a short burst into the enemy on Kugelbauer's tail. Seconds after being hit, the Hurricane burst into flames and plunged toward the desert. The British had now finished forming their defensive circle. Marseille once again pulled into a steep climb in order to gain the necessary altitude for the maneuver to follow. Kugelbauer made a sharp turn and joined up with him again. Now Marseille began his daredevil attack. He flipped his Bf-109 almost completely over, bearing down on the circle, spotted a gap and dove through. Racing through, he sensed rather than saw the most favorable firing position and punched the trigger. The dull thumping of the burst, shells puncturing the fuselage an inch in of his prey. And this second enemy was sent down. Marseille pulled up again. He heard Kugelbauer's voice over the intercom. "Man, Jochen, you've done it." Marseille was already climbing upward, with a maneuver resembling a half-barrel roll. His nose pointed directly at the sky. He continued climbing. The defensive circle had closed up even tighter. He got his third opponent in his sights, shot, and saw the enemy spiral earthward, trailing a banner of fire and smoke behind him. Then a blood-red fireball, and within a fraction of a second, the plane had been reduced to its individual components. Marseille maneuvered his own plane into a split S. Forces pushed him back into his seat. The straps began to hurt, and a few hundred meters below him, the remnants of the enemy plane drifted toward the ground. Again, Marseille pulled up into a zoom climb. Kugelbauer pulled his stick back to follow him. A massive weight seemed to be pressing down on the stabilizers. With a whistling sound, the two machines screamed upward. The voices in the intercom had become louder. Concerned warnings and calls were shouted. "Yellow one over," called the Staffelkapitän to Marseille, but there was no time to answer, for he was now plunging into the enemy's defensive circle once again. He fired at the point where he knew he had the right deflection. The target this time was a plane that had drifted a few dozen meters outside the flying carousel. Stricken, his enemy fell away in the direction of Sidi Barrani. Kugelbauer followed the diving aircraft and saw it impact near Bukbuk. A mushroom cloud shot up and in seconds metamorphosed into a tremendous column of smoke hanging over a thick mass of dust. "Keep your eyes on your fuel," called the Staffelkapitän, and Marseille saw that it was time to head back to base. The return flight to Ain El Ghazala turned into a triumphal journey for Marseille. He had shot down four of the enemy, three of them from out of their defensive circle. In doing so, he had scored kills number 20 to 23. Congratulations flowed in Marseille's direction over the intercom. The young Leutnant flew in his yellow 14 alongside his Rottenflieger, that's his wingman, Kugelbauer. He could see him clearly. He saw the face, frozen like a mask, gradually changing into a smile as the messages were transmitted. But Kugelbauer knew what price he had paid in carrying out three attacks through the hell of the enemy's formation. Flying at low level, the Staffel followed the Via Balbia along the desert floor. Their home base drew closer with every kilometer behind them. Behind the departing German planes, a few fire still glowed from the wrecks of the enemy aircraft. The first group of Jagdgeschwader 27 could report six kills for both Oberleutnant Homuth and Oberfeldwebel Kowalski had each destroyed a Hurricane. A short time later, the airplanes reached the edge of the airfield with its small hot tents and revetments built from sand-filled fuel tanks. All the planes broke off left and right. Lieutenant Marseille's Yellow 14 took center stage. The plane roared across the field at low altitude and waggled once. Then it climbed, did a chandelle, wiggled its wings again, flew once more across the airfield and waggled for the third time. Upon reaching the edge of the field, the plane pulled up, giving a final shake. Marseille brought his machine in for a landing. The landing gear extended and the BF-109 touched down, leaving a long cloud of dust behind it. Kugelbauer's aircraft was next, followed by the others of the Staffel. A quick interruption of the quote. In the English world, what pilots would do when celebrating a victory was a victory roll. They would roll the aircraft 360 degrees, but the Germans would wag their wings as a sign of an air victory. Quoting again, Marseille gave it a bit of throttle and taxied toward his parking spot. Arriving, he shut the engine off and lifted the canopy. His two ground crewmen were already up on the wings and lifted him out after he released the safety harness. The men carried their hero on their shoulders, not setting Marseille down until they stood in front of the Gruppenkommandeur, who stood near the edge of the field. Marseille walked over to his commander and reported his return from a combat flight. Hauptmann Neumann extended his hand to Marseille. His gaze fell onto the sweat-covered face of the happy flyer, still full of strain, yet already betraying the beginnings of his smile. Marseille, I congratulate you on your success. Kugelbauer, did you see them all? Asked Neumann of Marseille's wingman. The Oberfeindrich nodded. All of them, Herr Hauptmann, but I still can't believe it. The enemy's viewpoint of the battle is given in the history of the 1st South African Air Force Squadron and reads as follows. Our hurricanes had reached an altitude of 4,000 meters as the cliffs of the Halfaya Pass slid beneath them. In this moment, two groups of BF-109s were sighted ahead and approximately 1,000 meters higher. Estimates put their number at 24 aircraft. In the next breath, the Messerschmitts fell upon us. There was a wild, chaotic fight. The British fighters turned and chinked to defend themselves against this strong enemy, but they were hopelessly outclassed by the Messerschmitts, which were faster, climbed better, had more powerful armament, and also had an altitude advantage. Again and again, the BF-109s in groups of six or eight machines pounced on individual hurricanes, firing short bursts before climbing away from view. This was a unique view of the situation, since the British fighters were not flying in the air separated from each, but were in a large group, and they had formed up into a defensive circle. For the first time, Jagdgeschwader 27 appeared in the German Wehrmacht report, which mentioned them on the 25th of September with the following words. In North Africa, German fighters shot down seven British fighter planes and one bomber without loss to themselves east of Solom. The seventh fighter mentioned was the Tomahawk flown by the Australian Saunders. His plane had been shot down by Oberleutnant Homuth. End quote. And next week, the final part, for which I have saved, in my opinion, the most incredible days in Marseille's flying career. Not to give too much away, but on one day he shot down 17 enemy fighters.
Well, that's quite something. I don't know about you, Dennis, but you really feel like you're actually watching that. You know, the description there is really good. And just imagining that G-force that they were under, the force of that gravity, imagine the damage that must have actually done to them in later lives. If they have to have special suits for these pilots to wear now to compensate for the blood loss that they didn't have during the war, that must have done some physical damage to them, I would have thought, later in life. Just recently on the news, they said that roller coasters can actually help people to pass kidney stones. And just the G-force from a roller coaster can push the kidney stones out. They're actually talking about possibly using this as a surgical technique. And that's just from a roller coaster. So you imagine what state these pilots must have been in with X amount more gravity on them and doing it day in, day out. You know, they had to have been incredibly fit and they must have suffered physically from doing this in their later lives. I hope they were well looked after with pensions, these airmen. I know that they look on the airmen in a better way than they did on the other fighters during the war. The Germans seem to. But you would hope that they were really well looked after, because they would have physically been in a bad way after doing this, I would have thought. That was one thing that I thought about that. And also the sand. If you think they're in a sandstorm, did the sand affect the propellers at all on the planes?
Well, not the propellers, but the air coolers. They had to have special tropical versions, they called them. They had the designation TROP, TROP, for tropical. They had sand filters built in.
It must have been quite hard to try and land on the sand as well. You think they'd had to have built runways for all of this. They'd have had to have built a whole airport, which is quite some work. I mean, that they've had to do that in Syria, haven't they? The Russians had to sort of build their own airport before they could go in there and help Assad. It's quite an achievement to set up a theatre of war in the deserts of Africa using new technology and new techniques. I mean, flying like that was a new technique, flying at that sort of speed. And you don't imagine that the strength that was needed, as you were saying, for pulling on the stick there. Now, you imagine the power steering that everything has today. You had to be physically strong as well as able to put up with all this G-force. There's a lot more to it than you would think, anyway, these pilots in the war. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, well, what struck me straight away when Messerschmitt were talking about, they all used to actually gather around and watch these feats that he could do that nobody else, none of the other pilots could do. It took me back to an interview by Gary Lineker, believe it or not, who was a footballer at Barcelona, who used to watch Maradona train. And Maradona used to get the ball and kick the ball directly straight up into the air, and he'd come straight back down again, and he'd kick it straight back up again. Some of what seems remarkably simple to describe, none of the footballers could do it. And it just reminded me of these people coming to watch this pilot and what doing the things. To me, just like Maradona, these gifts are only God-given. And I don't think, you know, as many times as you can try to emulate them, I think it's impossible. I think these guys are given the gift, and it's straight from heaven.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, a very good way of looking at it. Schmidt, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we go into what Dennis has been researching this week?
Yes, these G-forces and potential damage to the body. I have never heard about lasting physical damage. The brain gets drained of oxygen, yes, but I don't think there's a lasting damage. But I could be wrong. I'm no expert in this. But fortunately, I've never heard of lasting damage to pilots from that. The airfields, as I said, they didn't even have to build runways because the 109 was capable of taking off in these. If you just dig a sand strip, that would be enough for the 109. And in Europe, they would be able to take off from normal fields, from grass fields or meadows.
That's quite amazing. We know we have seaplanes now and take off from sea. But I was just thinking about in space, you know, these astronauts that go up into space, they come back and their bodies are really damaged just by not having any gravity. So you would think that by having lots of gravity, even though it was just in short bursts, that it might do some damage as well as just draining the blood from the brain. If it's going to push out kidney stones and things like that. Anyway, if you're not sure of what damage it actually does, then maybe we'll have to look that up and discuss it next week. But thanks very much for that, Schmidt. Obviously, we'll have part 5 next week. And now we'll move on to what Dennis has been looking into this week. And I'm sure listeners will be pleased to know that there's going to be another episode of Communism by the Back Door. And I believe part of it is looking at Stalin. Is that right, Dennis?
Yeah, well, like I said a couple of weeks ago, like, you know, once I'd stopped the train and done the final one, it took me a while to get back into rhythm again. I started again this week. And the old part 22, this bonus part, is some of the things that I found along the way, which I didn't actually put into the actual series. So they're kind of the outtakes. And for instance, you know, it shows that there's proof that Wikipedia is run by Jews. You know, I talk a little bit about the Scottish independence vote, which we've got footage of it being rigged. And that then led me on to Stalin, because obviously Stalin comes in the picture. He's the guy with the quote who says, it's not the people who count the votes. It's not the people who vote that count, it's the people who count the votes that matter. So, and that little clip from the Scottish independence voting kind of seemed to sum it up. So it led me into Stalin, and there's a great mystery about Stalin, especially on the two questions: was he Jewish and was he a Freemason? I've got my own certain beliefs, but there's, you know, it's very hard to find any official stamps just to say that he was what he was. But going through it, I found some rather interesting things. And first of all, on the Freemason side, people have to understand that the Russian Revolution, Freemasonry was central to all that, and the leaders of the Bolsheviks, Lenin and Trotsky, were actually Freemasons. And looking into it, we found that Lenin was believed to be a member of possibly a couple of lodges. One was the Seven Sisters Lodge in Paris, and then there was also the Grand Orient Lodge, which Trotsky also belonged to. I actually got in touch with Jura Leary, who was a renowned expert on Freemasonry, to ask him about this question, whether Stalin was a Freemason or not. And he came back and believed that he wasn't. And he based that on the fact that Stalin purged Freemasonry, just like he purged Jura later on his career. But again, that didn't really, I mean, the fact that he purged Jura doesn't really convince me he wasn't a Jew. I mean, people have to remember, of course, that Stalin was a psychopath and would sleep easily, even if he had his own mother put down. So, well, you got to take that on board. I mean, obviously, Jura Leary did the documentary Under the Sign of the Scorpion, which was a great documentary, and others as well. So you must have got to bear that in mind as well. So, others, what I found on the internet, I found some various sources and said that Stalin was a member of the Rosicrucian Lodge. And another one said that he was a member of the Grand Orient Lodge, which, as I said earlier, was the same as Trotsky. And the thing about the Grand Orient Lodge is that it doesn't require a belief in a supreme being, which obviously most Freemasons, most lodges do. And this lack of requirement is why this Grand Lodge and all the other lodges on its roll are not recognised as regular Grand Lodges worldwide. Unlike the Seven Sisters Lodge, which Lenin was a member of, that is under jurisdiction and does require a belief in a supreme being. That supreme being, of course, is up for question. I've got my own thoughts on Freemasonry, whether it's my God or a God that, you know, the Jews tend to follow, is what I believe. It's not the same as my God. So, the difficulty with Freemasonry is obviously its secrecy. I mean, for a long time, I thought that women weren't allowed into Freemasonry, but there actually is a lodge which allows women in, and Blavatsky herself, the one and only Helena Blavatsky, turns out to be a Freemason as well. And that's just another reason why I debunk the fact that Hitler would ever sleep with the book she wrote, The Secret Doctrine, which is followed by Freemasons, which he destroyed, and the Lucy's Trust, which sits happily in the offices of the United Nations. And there's even another lodge, which most people think that the 33 degrees, the highest degree obtainable, and there's another lodge which takes it up to the 90th degree. So there's certainly airs of mystery and misinformation knocking around, which I'm quite sure hierarchy of Freemasons are quite happy with. The other bit of evidence, what I did find, was I have at least four photographs of Stalin, and actually there's a scene in The Greatest Story Never Told as he's leaving a building. He comes out in this pose with his hand on his breast behind, inside his jacket. And that is known as the hidden hand in Freemasonry. And not only have we got the footage of him coming out with this pose and the photos, there's also a statue of Stalin in the same pose, which is on the cover of a book called Stalin's Shadow by Rosamund Richards. And the question that you've got to ask is, does Stalin need to pretend he's a Freemason.
Or is that some kind of symbol where he's letting other Masons know that, like, their secret handshakes and the secret symbols? I mean, I would question where he said that Stalin purged the Jews. Like, Stalin got rid of some Jews. He didn't get rid of all the Jews. He got rid of one political faction that happened to be Jews. But there was another political faction that were still all Jews that were in power after him. His brother-in-law, Kaganovich, was a Jew and was the most powerful one of the lot. Now, I've got a book here. It's called Fraudulent Conversion, The Myth of Moscow's Change of Heart. And this was written by Colin Jordan. And it's basically challenging this idea that there were these purges of Jews and that Stalin purged these Jews. And I've got a quote here, which is actually about Stalin and his ethnic heritage itself. And it starts off, it says, the name of Stalin, Djugashvili, that is to say, in Georgian, son of an Israelite, Chivili son, and Juga Israelite. Now, that's not true. Juga may sound like Jew, but Juga is not Georgian for Jew. There's another word that actually means Jew, and Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson has debunked that one. But the rest of it, I think, sounds truthful. It continues, the family of Djugashvili, of Christian Orthodox religion, is described from the Jewish mountain dwellers of the Caucasus, converting at the beginning of the 19th century. And that's from My Career on the Soviet General Staff by Ivan Krylov, quoted in the Paris journal Le Nouveau Prometier in May 1951. And then we have The Life of Stalin by Iman Raguza, discussing on page 14 the parents of Stalin Besso and Kato Djugashvili. And they said, their marriage was not an affair of love. It was required by the customs of the country. The contract was concluded at Chishkin Valley, now called Stalinisere, and the young cobbler Besso, originally from the hamlet of Lilo, had a small cobbler's shop in this village. The father of Kato, Stalin's mother, was a Jew junk peddler in the mountains of Kutaisi. He also had a little novelty shop. So he may not have been born from a Jewish mother, but the father of his mother was a Jew. So he does have Jewish blood. And the fact that he has this Jewish blood, that may well explain the fact that he then had Jewish wives, Jewish mistresses, surrounded himself by Jews in his cabinet. And Colin Jordan goes on to just list all these Jews that have been around since that time. You've got Lazar M. Kaganovich, recurrently a member of the Party Central Committee, and since 1946 of its controlling body, Lavrenty Pavlovich Beria, the chief of the secret police from 1938. He was still a member of the subcommission to formulate a new party program in 1952. Lev Z. Meklis, head of the political department of the Red Army, minister of state control and editor of Pravda up to 1951. And he was also a member of the Party Central Committee, still at his death in 1953. Solomon Lazovsky, Director of Information Services, during and since World War II, Deputy Foreign Minister to 1951. Fyodor Gusev, Deputy Foreign Minister. A.M. Jacobson, Member of Presidium of Supreme Soviet, that's in 1951. Eugene Varga, originally Weisfeld, Stalin's Chief Economic Advisor, sent to Hungary in 1952. Ilya Ehrenberg, member of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, 1950, vice chairman of the World Peace Council, chief Soviet propagandist. Anatoly Josefovich Lavrentiev, or originally Lipman, deputy foreign minister, 1949 to 1951. He has headed Soviet diplomatic missions in the period of Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, and Czechoslovakia, and Persia. Alexei F. Gorkin, Secretary of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet from 1937 to 1953. P.A. Judin, Minister of Heavy Industrial Construction in 1951. I.A. Levine, Vice President of Building in 1950. David Jakovlevich Reiser, sometime Minister for Heavy Industry Construction, appointed to the Party Central Committee in 1952. Pavel Judin, Editor of the Cominform Journal, circa 1951. Member of the Party Central Committee in 1952, sent to Bulgaria in 1952 and East Germany in 1953. Maxim Litvinov, veteran Soviet diplomat, finally retired from post of Deputy Foreign Minister in 1946, Party Organizational Director circa 1951, now deceased, A.M. Kirchenstein, Deputy Chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, Peter Levitsky, Deputy Chairman of the Council of Nationalities, 1951, B.A. Davinsky, Minister of Agricultural Stocks, 1951, S.Z. Ginsburg, Minister of Building Materials, 1951, Semyon Yakovlevich Fomin, Minister of Building Machinery and Industry, 1951, D.L. Fomin, Minister of Food and Material Reserves, 1951, Ivan Izodorovich Nosenko, Assistant Minister of Shipbuilding Industry, 1951, N. Yakovlev, Head of the Schools Department of the Party Central Committee, 1952, and we got three more, Vanneker, Minister of Agricultural Machinery, 1948, Mark Spivak, Minister of Agriculture for the Ukraine, 1954, and George F. Alexandrov, Minister of Culture in 1954. So all of those are all Jews, all in high positions after the supposed purges of Jews by Stalin. So they're still running things.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, there's a rumour that the Jews poisoned him, but it's only a rumour. I mean, I do believe he was poisoned, but... I tend to agree. I mean, during that time, you've got to remember as well, only Jews were allowed to leave the Soviet Union as well because to go to Israel. So there's a huge Jewish influence at that time in the country after Stalin. But just to back that up in a way, I mean, I've got the Jew David Wiseman. He claims he was wholly Jewish in the B'nai B'rith Messenger. The 3rd of March, 1950, on page 19. Like I said, B'nai B'rith was instrumental in the Russian Revolution. And I've also got, where's he gone now? Gregory Kilmov. He says that Stalin was half Jew. So, you know, this talk about blood, this Jew blood being in Stalin, you know, he's certainly not being denied. This Jewish doctor and publicist, Salomon, by the way, you're better at these Russian names than I am, Shulman, admitted in Sweden that Stalin could speak Yiddish and referred to the Yiddish language, by the publisher Die Goldene Kayat, 1962, as his source. And another meeting where Stalin was talking to two Jewish poets, Abraham Skuchkiewicz and Shlomo Michels, who was commissioner for propaganda. Skuchkiewicz discussed problems of Yiddish culture, which Stalin was also familiar with.
Yiddish was the language of the revolution, wasn't it? Yiddish. All the revolutionaries spoke Yiddish.
Yeah, at one point they tried to make the whole population turn to speak Yiddish. And the fact that this Stalin could speak Yiddish, it was apparently one of the Soviet Union's most guarded state secrets. Okay. Stalin became a fairly obedient tool of the international financial elite. This is going back, of course, to the West funding. I've always said, you know, I play a big part in the Soviet Union, this funding from the West. Lazar Kaganovich.
He's the one.
Made sure he followed all the important directives and Stalin allowed no anti-Semitism at all at the beginning. It says here, Stalin had an article about the most efficient ways to combat anti-Semitism published in the Pravda, number 41, in February 1929. So again, we see him again leaning towards the Jews. Back in 1924, a serious conflict developed. Now, we were talking about the neocons a little bit earlier, about the Trotskyites and the Stalinists, and we couldn't really go any further. I hadn't really gone down that road, but this is apparently where it all stems from. This conflict developed between the Western Haskalah and the Eastern Hasidic-oriented Jews in Russia. The Western Jews wanted Trotsky as the chief of the regime, and the Eastern Jews preferred either the half-Jew or the full-Jew, Stalin, and wanted to remove as many Western Jews as possible from the corridors of power. So there's a power struggle in the Soviet Union for the Western and the Eastern Jews, who's going to come out on top, and which of these criminal groups would eventually rule. and the East-orientated Jews managed to gain the upper hand on the 21st of May 1924, when it was Stalin re-elected as General Secretary of the Central Committee. And obviously we know at one stage Trotsky was assassinated by one of Stalin's guys out there in South America. So in 1936, the same guy who'd eagerly proposed Stalin for leadership, Zinoviev, he had a great fortune, which Stalin wanted, and Stalin eventually required it by torture. It took something like 60 million Swiss francs from another one called Gansky. And the Czechists tortured a guy called Bela Kun for 3 days before he would give in and told them where his fortune was hidden. But all the American Jews apparently were left alone, obviously not wanting to upset some of the Western finances, no doubt. But anti-Semitism continued to grow amongst the population. In 1927, Nikolai Berkerin said, "We have never before had such extreme anti-Semitism as we have now. It became even worse later, despite the founding of a special bureau in the Central Committee of the Young Communists, known as Komo Samol, for the purpose of fighting anti-Semitism." And it was strange that all these decisions this place made were all state secrets. For example, there was a resolution on the 2nd of November 1926 where it was laid down the primary aim of the Young Communist Committee was to combat anti-Semitism in society.
Anti-Semitism. Well, there were these different factions. There's always been these different factions between the Jews. And you were saying there that there was the Eastern group and the Western group, and the Eastern group won out. But later on, there was the Zionist group and the Communist group. And that's what these political factions were fighting for power in the Soviet Union. Because the Soviets didn't want the Jews to go off to Israel, and the Zionists did want the Jews to go off to Israel. So you had these fights between them. There's always been these fights between the Jews and fighting among themselves. And the only thing they're actually united on is their anti
rule in the world
gentle anti-Gentile behavior is what they're united on. Is on their hatred of non-Jews, specifically white Christian people, are the ones that they hate. That's what they're united in. That's why you have right-wing Jews, left-wing Jews, Zionist Jews, communist Jews.
Sure.
But all together, they all want to do away with anti-Semitism. They think criticizing Jews should get the death penalty, which is what Stalin instituted, wasn't it? The death penalty for anti-Semitism.
Yeah, this is what psychopaths do, I suppose. They take great delight in it. I mean, the power of a death sentence. I mean, Bush had the same attitude, to be quite honest, young Bush. Whereas, this power you have over life and death, these psychopaths seem to revel in it. I mean, finally, I've got here. Obviously, with this Young Communist Committee, the primary aim is to combat all this anti-Semitism, said it at last. That was why Stalin proclaimed on January the 1st, 1931, that the communists resolutely condemn anti-Semitism and that in the Soviet Union, anti-Semitism is punished in the most severe manner.
That could be said today, couldn't it? That could be David Cameron saying that. Could be Theresa Easily. May saying that, couldn't it?
Easily. Any Jew in power would say that, yeah.
It doesn't change. I mean, we may be under a soft power today. We're not being sent off to Siberia and tortured like the Cheka did.
But, do you know why I think that
it's
is,
a soft power? They don't need to. They don't need to, do they?
They don't need. They've got the television. Since that television has been put in that corner, it kind of propagates all the propaganda and it gets people thinking down a certain line that you don't really need to take them off to a gulag now and persuade them. It's already done in your front room.
And a lot of that was just done just to be evil. There was no point to what they were actually doing to the people that they sent to the gulags. Absolutely pointless, the work that they were doing. And they were just starving them. If they fed them, they would have got better work out of them. But they weren't doing it to get work out of them. They were just doing it out of the sake of being purely wicked and evil. And I think a lot of the stuff on the television is done purely out of a desire to be wicked and evil and corrupt the Goyim.
Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, my wife's been a fan of Coronation Street. I mean, I've always said, by the way, there's no programme good enough to be on TV for that long. And Coronation Street, it's now been on, I don't know, 50 years at least, something like that. And it's got to the point now where even the wife, who is an adamant fan, you know, has to kind of question the motive when, you know, the guys are kissing every 2 minutes on the programme. You know, I've always said that it manipulates the audience. I mean, once over it showed a girl headbutting another girl, and this is a bit in the 1990s, and I said at the time that in the nightclub on the weekend coming, there will be some girls getting headbutted, which was unheard of at that time. But because of this produced show was shown on Coronation Street and people react to these things, you know, even subconsciously, sure enough, you know, girls headbutting people and getting into manly fights, and this is what's going to happen with the gay thing as well. It's looking so normal now. It's just indoctrination. They don't need to go to a gulag anymore and torture. It's like you say, it's like a soft approach and subtle and more sublime in what they do.
Monkey see, monkey do. I mean, these soap operas, I mean, you got EastEnders, you got homosexuals in it, transsexuals in it, lesbians in it, queers.
Never watched that, believe it or not. I didn't know that.
There's only one step next that they can take, really, which is to try and portray your paedophiles sympathetically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And get everyone feeling sorry for a paedophile. I mean, that's really the only next step that they can take in depravity, because that's what it is. It's one more step each time to deprave the audience that little bit more and degrade them. It's like they're taking great joy in doing this. Now that they've got to the top, now that they control the media, they take great pleasure in corrupting us and putting absolute poison on there. You know, that's why we just got to be so thankful that we do have the internet. We can get away from that. And that's what that's what these podcasts are about. This is what Radio Aryan is about. It's about providing content for people that they can listen to, they can learn from it, they can laugh at it, they can interact with it, instead of watching this poison that the Jewish media puts out on the television. We all like to be entertained. We all like to have something to listen to while we're doing stuff. And now you've got something positive that you can listen to. You know, that was a lot of the thinking behind putting out, you know, regular podcasts like this one. So it's not all bad. It's not all bad. But we're coming to the end of the podcast now, Dennis. So you better let people know where they can find your work before we finish.
Yeah, as always, thegreatstorynevertold.tv and comingsandbythebackdoor.tv for the documentaries. Also, YouTube channel and Dennis Wise and what's the other one? Oh, my Facebook page, Dennis Wise. Come and join me. Having fun on there lately.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Okay, well, hopefully next time we will be back. We will be back with a live broadcast for you. So thank you, Messerschmitt. Thank you, Dennis. And thank you very much, listeners. Please tune in again next time for more Truth Without Radio. Same time, same place on Radio Aryan. Have a great weekend. Yeah.